There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Merkle Media.
Good, everybody. This is Joel Thomas, and this is Free the Rabbits. And how are all the free range rabbits doing out there today? First off, I want to say thank you to everyone that's been lighting up the 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, leaving great comments, liking, sharing on YouTube. Thank you so much for doing so. If you've been following the show and you haven't done so yet, please, while it's on your mind and I'm talking to you right now, go give it a 5-star review. Go leave a comment where you can. It helps the show grow and it helps it get deeper into the algorithm where people that don't normally get a hold of the show get a hold of the show. If you're new to the show, hey, wait until you listen to it. And if you feel like it's worthy of a 5-star review or a great comment, go and do it as soon as the show's over with. Also, YouTube memberships are up and running. This is not to give you any new content or keep anything behind a paywall. This is just for people that have been asking how they can donate to the show. It's one of two ways I have available right now to donate directly to the show. Just go to the membership section here on YouTube, and there are three different tiers with different perks for each. But generally, it's just a way for people to be able to donate to the show and help the show grow. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/freetherabbits, and you can donate by one payment there if you'd rather do that. Also, for everyone that has been asking for the past several months, Free the Rabbits intro song is up as a single. Just go to Spotify, just go to Apple Music, go to YouTube, type in Joel Thomas, Free the Rabbits, and you will find that song available to add to any of your playlists, so you can listen to that song as much as you want without having to rewind to the beginning of the episode as your only way of doing so. All right, guys, let's get into the episode. What's good, guys? We are back with part three of my Good Nephilim series, which will be the final part of this particular series. Not to say that down the road, as I continue my research with this particular theory, that there might be addendum episodes that are added as I'm discovering new things. Because it seems like that every time that I think I've boxed in this theory enough, it expands even more and more and more as I'm looking at other theories that sometimes have nothing to do with Nephilim at all, but they find their strong arms creeping through all kind of different subjects, and sometimes they end up being of the quote-unquote good type. So just giving people a heads up, just because this will be the final episode of this particular series doesn't mean I won't revisit the topic later on with more research that I'm doing, because I'm trying to compile as much evidence as I can to give people a solid basis to be able to look at this wholly and say, hey, this is a huge possibility that this particular narrative that all Nephilim are evil is shoddy at best. And to be honest with you, that's the same thing with any type of theory. It's just a theory, and we can get very deep rooted in these theories sometimes, and we can think we have it all figured out. And when we do, we get very angry and anxious when something is presented that is the antithesis of that. And I find that with myself too. And I've learned that if I'm feeling a certain way towards something, that makes me actually want to go look into it and try to understand it as much as possible. And a lot of times I find out that there's some sort of validity or truth to it, because like I've said from the beginning of this entire show, that most of these theories have some basis of truth in them somewhere. We're just trying to dig around and find out what it might be. But I'm very excited to get to this episode today. I've had several people hit me up, excited that I'm going to talk about the Rh negative blood type as a part of this. But I'm also going to talk about another set of possible good Nephilim from the Bible. Not extra canonical, not apocryphal, not historically, but from the Bible. Now, David's Mighty Men, part one. Well, the reason for that is they're not technically part of David's Mighty Men. They worked with David, but they're not a part of the Mighty Men themselves. These were a separate group of people, but this is from the Bible. And I'm also going to break down in the Hebrew what some of these words mean to show you that from all intents and purposes, it looks like that these are hybrids of some sort that worked with David during a period of time he was running from Saul as he was amassing his own army. So you will get the bigger picture of who these guys are. But it starts with the Gadites, the tribe of Gad. And according to the Bible, it was one of the 12 tribes of Israel who, after the Exodus from Egypt, settled on the eastern side of the Jordan River. It is one of the 10 lost tribes. 10 lost tribes is a highly controversial topic. You wouldn't think so, but it is, because there are tons of people globally who claim that they are of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And to be honest with you, it's possible. I'm not saying that these people aren't, but I will say this. It is virtually impossible for any of us to track our bloodlines back to these specific tribes of Israel. Now, there could be in some elite circles ways to track these bloodlines back, but I can say this, there's too much evidence of these particular tribes being scattered from Israel itself and settling down multiple places globally. And to say that we have it figured out who these 10 lost tribes are, I think is very haughty and arrogant of us. And I also think it lends to that Hebrew elitism that I've talked about a lot, especially last episode. I talked about a good bit, and we won't go through that too much today. But I just wanted to set the tone about these 10 lost tribes and how that there is this narrative that people think they know exactly who these 10 lost tribes are and where they're actually at, where they settled down at. But there's too much evidence in books from all over. As a matter of fact, recently I received a book that had some genealogies in it and some chronologies in it that tracks some of these tribes even to the UK. So this narrative that they all settled down in some portion of Africa or the United States only, I believe is ludicrous. And I think it's the same thing when we're looking at groups of people like the Edomites, because the Edomites are another one that integrated into Rome and Germany and multiple countries where we don't know exactly where all of these Edomites are. And I think this goes with any type of nationality of people or groups of people from ancient times. I think they dispersed from all over and integrated into many different cultures and many different countries. So I think it's very difficult for us to pinpoint down and say that we know for a fact where these tribes located as a whole, because many of them dispersed in multiple directions. So it's just not possible, especially after a lot of the Babylonian conflicts that went down. It's very arrogant of us to think that we could have that all figured out. But I do think it's very fascinating, and I think that we can have a lot of theories about what happened to the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Some of these tribes, and I know I've listened to some other theologians and Nephilim researchers who have talked about Nephilim bloodlines being integrated into some of these lost tribes and them having some origins of Nephilim bloodlines, which I don't know about as a whole, right? I think that some of them did. Again, back to the Edomites, we know that Esau settled down around Mount Seir. And from all indications from apocryphal text that he was integrating his bloodlines in with hybrids and this tribes, I think it's very interesting. And I do think that we can look at scripturally, especially with this particular tribe, the tribe of Gad, and talk about at least some of them having some sort of Nephilim origin or hybrid origin that gave them some of this supernatural strength and supernatural power. However, the caveat is, I don't think that human beings can't have access to God's infinite supernatural power in battle. And I do think that that's represented in David's mighty men, because in my opinion, most of David's mighty men were more than likely of human origins, and they weren't of Nephilim origins. But I do think that there could have been a small portion that were. But this particular group of the tribe of Gad is very interesting, and I did want to go into it today because I think that it'll give us an even greater appreciation for hybrids having the ability to be redeemed by Yahweh and be allowed to join his side and fight for what is true and just in the world. And you'll see that narrative throughout the entire Bible. Now, to the 10 lost tribes, those are from the 12 tribes of Israel that were said to have been exiled from the kingdom of Israel after it was conquered by the Neo-Assyrian Empire around 720 BC. They were the following: Reuben, Simeon, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Manasseh, Ephraim, and then all but Judah and Benjamin, both of which were based in the neighboring kingdom of Judah, therefore survived until the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem in 587 BC. So Judah and Benjamin were the ones that dealt with that Babylonian siege that I was just talking about. Now, Jewish historian Josephus, which I've talked about Josephus on the last episode, wrote that there are but two tribes in Asia and Europe subject to the Romans, while the 10 tribes are beyond Euphrates till now, and are an immense multitude and not to be estimated by numbers. In the 7th and 8th centuries CE, the return of the 10 lost tribes was associated with the concept of the coming of the Hebrew Messiah. Claims of descent from the lost tribes have been proposed in relation to many groups, and some Abrahamic religions espouse a messianic view that the Israel's tribes will return. So I know that there is some talk in the Christian sphere and the Judea sphere of these 10 tribes coming back when the Messiah returns. Now, it depends on what you believe. If you're a Christian, at least in some versions of Christianity, which would be considered your pre-tribulation idea, would consider that these tribes would come back together before the return of Christ. Now, if you are in the Judaism viewpoint, then this would be when the Messiah comes for the first time. So two different varying views there, and there's always a lot of offshoot views within Christianity too. And we've talked about the idea of post-millennial views, even the possibility of us actually already being in the short season of a few thousand years, but we won't get into all that today. But that's just setting the tone for what Josephus has said. Now, the idea saying that these 10 tribes are beyond the Euphrates from Josephus lends to a lot of people thinking that they were all together in a large group somewhere in Africa, right? This is where people get the historical idea of that. The problem with that is so many people, when they dispersed and they went across the Euphrates, that's not denoting where they actually settled, not in the slightest, because we know that even in ancient Egyptian times, there is knowledge of Egyptians coming to the Americas, setting up shop in the Americas. And I plan on doing an episode very soon about ancient Egypt in the Americas. But we know that tons of different countries and civilizations had come to the Americas and other parts of the world by boat and by whatever other means. If you want to go down the esoteric route of portaling and stargates, that would be a whole nother discussion. But let's just say that they're getting to these other places somehow. That's a long period of time from even the Assyrian captivity times when they started dispersing to say that they all just lumped together in one place. Now, they would have dispersed even in small groups out of these tribes as well. So these are thousands and thousands of years ago. We can't sit there and pinpoint down even what Josephus is saying right now, that they were all in one place. There could have been a large group of people in one place, but it doesn't mean all the tribes were there altogether. And I don't think that in the slightest. And I would say that for any nationality or culturally, any group of people throughout history, I think you more times than not, especially when it comes to war, you will see them dispersed over different areas, depending on what they're running from or who they're fighting. So the biblical narrative is after the conquest of the land by Joshua. Now, this is when Joshua and Caleb, they come into the promised land to take it back after they've been in the wilderness for 40 years. This is after the original 10 spies saw all of the Anakim, Raphaim, Nephilim, Og, Sion, his brother, all these giants in there. This is when Joshua and Caleb come in with the Israelites and start taking it back. And this was until the formation of the first kingdom of Israel in 1050 BC. The tribe of Gad was part of a loose confederation of Israelite tribes. No central government existed, and in the times of crisis, the people were led by leaders known as judges from the book of Judges. In the first book of Samuel, King Nahash of Ammon, of the Ammonites, appears abruptly as the attacker of Jabesh-Gilead, which lay outside the territory he laid claim to. Having subjected the occupants to a siege, the population sought terms for surrender and were told by Nahash that they had a choice of death by the sword or having their right eyes gouged out. Now, this is significant. You may wonder, why are they to have their right eyes gouged out? Well, in battle, you would have your shield in your left arm and you would have it raised to protect yourself, while in your right hand, you would have a weapon of some sort. Now, while your shield is raised, your left eye, you wouldn't be able to see out of. Your right eye is what you would use to be able to see the enemy. By Nahash taking out the right eye of the tribe of Gad, it would basically turn them into eunuchs of war. They would be castrated in battle because they wouldn't be able to see with their shield raised over their left eye if their right eye was plucked out. And if they dropped their shield to be able to see what was going on in battle, they would be exposed and would be killed too. So this was his way of castrating them to where they would not be able to fight his people at all, or fight anyone for that matter. Now, the population obtained 7 days grace from Nahash, during which they would be allowed to seek help from the Israelites. So he's flexing on them. He's saying that they won't even come help you. These Israelites aren't even going to help you. Again, tribe of Gad, loose confederation of Israelite tribes. And we're going to talk about in a minute too, a mixture of some other things too. The occupants, this tribe of Gad, sought help from the people of Israel, sending messengers throughout the whole territory. And Saul, this is King Saul, before he was king, a herdsman at this time, responded by raising an army which decisively defeated Nahash and his cohorts at Bezek. Now, as the Philistines and some of these other countries grew in opposition, the Israelite tribes decided to form a strong centralized monarchy to meet the challenge, and the tribe of Gad joined the new kingdom with Saul as the first king. So Saul was the first king of the newly formed Israelites in the Promised Land. Now, after the death of Saul, all the tribes other than Judah remained loyal to the house of Saul. But after the death of Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, successor to the throne of Israel, the tribe of Gad joined the other northern Israelite tribes in making Judah's king David the king of a reunited kingdom of Israel. And I hope most people know the story of King David and King Saul and the split there, and how David was on the run from Saul and was building up his own army to defeat Saul and take his right as king, because after killing Goliath, he was looked at by most Israelites as the successor of Saul, and Saul wasn't ready to give it up. And Saul, doing some nefarious things that he did, even talking to a witch to try to get some sort of leg up on David, just kept spiraling out. And you will see this happen time and time again throughout the Bible with great men, but you'll also see the theme of redemption with a lot of them too. Now, following the completion of the conquest of Canaan by the Israelite tribes after about 1200 BC, Joshua allocated the land among the 12 tribes. However, in the case of the tribes of Gad, Reuben, and half of Manasseh, Moses allocated land to them on the eastern side of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea. The tribe of Gad was allocated to the central region of the three, east of Ephraim and west Manasseh, though the exact location is ambiguous. So again, we don't really know where they settled even after they were allocated land to them. And you'll see this with many different people of many different cultures as they spread out. We don't even know where portions of those people go to. There may be a central portion that stays, but there may be several other groups that disperse off and migrate to other lands, which I think that the Americas at some point probably had several different cultures and people of all kind of different ancient lineages throughout, giants included. Now, there's actual archaeological evidence for the tribe of Gad. It is mentioned in the Mesha Stele, and we've talked about steles before on here, especially when we talked about the dog-headed men. And we talked about that stele that was found in South America that had one of those weird hybrids on it from the book of Jasher. Now, there was a stele that was found, and the date on it was 840 BC. And this is where the Moabite king Mesha boasts about his conquest of Ataroth or Ashtaroth. Keep that in mind. And the men of Gad dwelled in the country of Ataroth from ancient times, and the king of Israel fortified Ataroth. Also, Mesha calls his father Chemosh Gad, king of Moab, the Dibonite, indicating that Dibon was already a major Moabite settlement for a long time. This shows that in the middle of the 9th century BC, the Moabites still recognized Gad as a separate tribe and as a part of the kingdom of Israel, but had been pushing them north for a long while. So I find it interesting that Ataroth comes up, which is another form of Ashtaroth. And we've talked about Ashtaroth, and we will hear again today. And we know that the Moabites are connected to this Ataroth, and this idea that some of these Moabites even had these hybrids, these lion-like men of Moab. And I want you to keep that in your mind right now as we talk about lion-like men of Moab, as we dig deep into some of these members of the tribe of Gad and what their hybridization was as well, and how this interesting connection between these Moabites in Ataroth with the men of Gad, also in Ataroth, how some of each of them have a very similar hybrid trait. And it's fascinating and it's biblical, which I think's even more cool that it's actually in the Bible where we find both of these hybridized versions in the tribe of Gad and the Moabites. So back to this origin of the tribe of Gad and how I was talking about that not all of them were of Israelite origin. So according to the Torah, the tribe consisted of descendants of Gad, the seventh son of Jacob, from whom it took its name. However, some biblical scholars view this also as a postdiction and an eponymous metaphor, providing an ideology of the connectedness of the tribe to others in the Israelite confederation. In the biblical account, Gad is one of two descendants of Zilpah, a handmaid of Jacob, the other descendant being Asher. Scholars see this as indicating that the author saw Gad and Asher as being not of entirely Israelite origin. So keep that name Asher in your mind for a little bit later when we get to this Rh negative, when we talk about these bloodlines, because it's interesting how scholars saw Gad and Asher as not being of entirely Israelite origin. And I think that this lends to the idea of there being hybrids within this particular tribe, which I talked about earlier. There are plenty of Nephilim researchers that have talked about when it comes to the 10 lost tribes, how many of them were integrated in with hybrids of some sort. Now, the fate of the tribe of Gad, though initially forming part of the kingdom of Israel, from the biblical account, appears that under Uzziah and Jotham, the tribe of Gad joined with the kingdom of Judah instead. Victim to the actions of the Assyrians, and the tribe were exiled. And in the Talmud, it is Gad, along with the tribe of Reuben, that are portrayed as being the first victims of this fate. So they were, along with the tribe of Reuben, kicked out first during this Assyrian takeover. Now, the Ethiopian Jews, also known as Beta Israel, which we talked about in the last episode, claimed descent from the tribe of Dan, whose members migrated south along with the members of the tribes of Gad, Asher, and Naphtali into the kingdom of Cush, now Ethiopia and Sudan, during the destruction of the first temple. The Igbo in Nigeria claimed descent from Gad through his son Eri, also the name of their first king. So I'm not saying that some of that couldn't be true, and I'm not going to discount everything that comes out of Beta Israel by any stretch, but I can say that these tribes dispersed in so many different areas and regions. They didn't go to just one place. So coupled with the fact that they were integrating in with hybrids as well, we don't know exactly where they all went. And I think many people of all different races could have some sort of connection to the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Now, I set the tone. We're going to get into the biblical text of how I think that there was at least a group of the tribe of Gad who were hybrids. And I find this fascinating, and it's another great example of Nephilim, of hybrids being given redemption by Yahweh. Now, we're going to start in 1 Chronicles 12, and this is when the mighty men joined David at Ziklag. Now, again, there are mighty men talked about with David, but these particular men are not the mighty men. These are just another grouping of men from the tribe of Gad. Now, we're going to jump to verse 8 of 1 Chronicles 12. Some Gadites defected to David at his stronghold in the desert. They were mighty men of valor. So this mighty men is Gibbari, which is the same meaning as Gibbarim, which you've talked about several times. G-I-B-B-O-R-E for mighty men. So we could say, and it could be argued, that these are just mighty men, very similar to the human mighty men that are part of David's actual 30 mighty men, because the word Gibbarim is also used in conjunction with those guys. But let's not even cut out the fact that some of those mighty men, the 30 of David's, seemingly have these abilities, and the Moabites of old living in the same area. So it's got me thinking, when I get to this part of this verse, it's going to have you thinking too, even deeper about Ithma the Moabite possibly being one of these lion-like men of Moab. But here we are in verse 8. Mighty men, Gibbari, trained for battle, experts with the shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and who were as swift as gazelles on the mountains. Now, the consensus from a lot of mainstream theologians who don't adhere to some of the wilder context out of the Bible, and I say wilder because of them, it's wild. The idea that fallen angels could have relations with human women, create these Nephilim, these giants, could have relations with animals and create hybrids. To them, it's a fairy tale, it's fiction. But the reality of it is, in the Hebrew, these people knew what they were talking about. And in this particular verse, when we dig into the Hebrew, we realize that they're not writing it as a metaphor. So the part it says whose faces were like is Panim. Now, Panim, you take out the Pane or Panim, and that stands for face. Were like is an English and Latin word, two words that were added. That's not actually there in Hebrew. It would be more indicative to say whose faces were the faces of lions. It wasn't like, because that's not what that means in the Hebrew. It means faces. It's indicative of what these men's faces looked like. It wasn't a sign of valor or they were mighty like a lion. No, it goes directly into the word lion in this instance is Ari. Where have we heard Ari before? Well, I can tell you where we heard Ari before. 2 Samuel 23:20. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done many acts, he slew two lion-like men of Moab. Ari stands for lion, and El stands for godlike. These were hybrids. This is the same Ari that's used when it's talking about lions. Faces of lions. Not like, faces of lions. Take that word like out of there that was added, whose faces were of lions, and they were swift as gazelles on the mountains. Now, swift is maher, M-A-H-E-R, hastening, speedy, swift. So in this instance, it is talking about the physicality of how fast that these Gadites, these men, could move. So looking into the deeper Hebrew here, we find the correlation, the connection to 2 Samuel 23:20 and 1 Chronicles 11:22, which is Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done many acts. He slew two lion-like men of Moab. Also, he went down and slew a lion in a pit in a snowy day. So these are very similar verses. They're just in two different books. But the aureole is used the exact same way in both of those verses. And the Ari is the same version of lion that we see in verse 8 of 1 Chronicles 12. So that got me pretty jacked up because I'm thinking about these Gadites, these army commanders. And we'll go to verse 9 here. Ezer the chief, Obadiah the second command, Eliab the third, Mishmanah the fourth, Jeremiah the fifth, Atte the sixth, Eliel the seventh, Johanan the eighth, Elzabad the ninth, Jeremiah the tenth, and Machbani the 11th. These Gadites were army commanders, the least of whom was a match for 100 and the greatest for 1,000. So the least of them, one man could take out 100 other men, or in the context of the Hebrew, these hybrids could take out one man. The greatest of them could take out 1,000 men. One man. Now, I know I'll get pushback from the non-hybrid believing or Nephilim giant fallen angel created believing Christian who will say that, oh, God can't give people power to do that. Absolutely. And I think that is very evident when you're looking at these human mighty men. We can look at Samson. We can look at so many different characters throughout biblical history where God has given human beings the power to do things supernaturally, not discounting that. The issue is when the Bible is clearly, specifically in the Hebrew, talking about some sort of hybrid or giant doing something miraculous, that we try to disavow that piece of it. And I don't think we should here. I mean, think about it. You have these lion-faced men who can run like gazelles and move like gazelles through the mountains, who the least of them can take out 100 men. The greatest could take out 1,000 men. This is crazy. And the best part is they pledge to David. We can go to verse 16. Other Benjamites and some men from Judah also came to David. This is in conjunction with the tribe of Gad, these portion of the tribe of Gad, came to David in a stronghold. And David went out to meet them, saying, "If you have come to me in peace to help me, my heart will be united with you. But if you've come to betray me to my enemies, when my hands are free of violence, may the God of our fathers see it and judge you." Verse 18, then the Spirit came upon Amasai, the chief of the 30, and he said, "We are yours, O David. We are with you, O son of Jesse. Peace, peace to you and peace to your helpers, for your God helps you." So David received them and made them leaders of his troops. So he receives these generals, these commanders from the tribe of Gad, these hybrids, to actually become leaders of his troops. Now, we're not talking about part of the mighty men, but we are talking about becoming leaders of the many troops that he's building. But I find this so fascinating, and again, shows the grace mercy that God has over every portion of creation, even manipulated creation. And I think this is another fantastic example of that. And I just think that it's a crazy tie-in between these lion-like men of Moab, these portion of the tribes of Gad who are lion-faced men who can move like gazelles. Are they from a similar hybridization? I really started thinking about that. And it brought me to that Meshastili that we were just talking about, where we talk about the Moabite king Mesha and the men of Gad who dwelled in the country of Ataroth from ancient times, side by side with these Moabites. Was there some sort of hybridization going on there? Was some sort of, I don't know, lion god, or what they consider to be a lion god, some sort of lion-man hybrid that hybridized with them, that created maybe offshoots in the Moabites, in the tribe of Gad? I don't know. I find it interesting, though, that we've got two particular type of lion-like men. They're described a little differently, but the Hebrew words match up, and the origins of them were in the same region. And this is just according to archaeology in this region, these Moabites, tribe of Dan, that there was something going on with some sort of lion god, lion hybrid, fallen entity that was manipulating the genome with some of the people of these groups of people. And I think that is how my mind started going to it as I was matching it up. But I did want to talk about these lion-faced men of the tribe of Dan and how ridiculously strong they were. And I believe it's another fascinating example of these hybrids who have been redeemed biblically. We're not even talking about extra-canonically. We're talking about biblically. And I thought this would be a great way to kick off this episode as we now delve into a little bit darker topic, at least to some people, of this Rh negative blood type. Now, there are tons of theories that have surrounded this Rh negative blood type. You probably have seen entire episodes done on ancient aliens, where they consider this to be from alien manipulation of the human genome. And there are all kind of other theories about what this Rh negative blood type has with it that's connected to the supernatural world. Now, I want to preface it by saying this. I think this is like any theory that we look at. I think there could be some truths to it, but I also think there's definitely some fear-mongering that's going on with it too. especially within the Christian community. And I believe I talked about it briefly on last episode, but I had several people reach out to me and say that there are people within the Christian community that are telling people that have Rh negative blood type that they cannot be redeemed because the narrative of there never being any Nephilim that could be redeemed in certain circles of Christianity has led these people to believe that. That's fear-mongering. That's not true. And I will stand on that. So we can argue about all the different canonical and extra-canonical and historical texts I've talked about in the last three episodes, and whether you believe in them or not, or the validity of them, that's perfectly fine. But to espouse that someone cannot be redeemed is foolhardy on your part. And may God help us all if we're doing that to anyone. And I would hope that I would never do that to anyone either, because only God can judge, not human beings. And I think that's very evident as I'm digging through this good Nephilim theory. But where the idea of this Rh negative blood type comes from, at least in the conspiracy theory world, it comes from essentially one of a few places, right? We've either got the ancient aliens theory that these were some sort of highly evolved extraterrestrial who came down and started manipulating us, helped quote unquote create us. And as a part of that, in their continued manipulation, they added a little bit of their extraterrestrial selves to our blood type. And this is where this Rh negative blood type comes from. And this is why people seemingly have these supernatural or alchemical abilities or proclivities to being able to do things that the average person could normally do is because they have this alien DNA inside of them. The other one is reptilian blood, because people will point to the 13 bloodlines and say that they are of draconian nature, and people that have this draconian blood, this reptilian blood, are of this Rh negative blood type. And the other one is that people that have the Rh negative blood type are of Nephilim origin. Now, I'm not going to throw it all out. I know it sounds super crazy, all the three things I said to the average person, but I think there's some validity to the Rh negative blood type because there are some weird things that tend to surround it, but it's not always indicative in every case, because I know people that have Rh negative that don't have any of these things happen to. So we have to put that in our minds as well. Also, is the fact that you have Rh negative blood and you are aware of the implications of what that could mean, maybe you've listened to a lot of podcasts or listened to people say that you have Nephilim blood, does that unknowingly unlock entities to come and attack you because you've now awakened yourself to thinking you have this Nephilim blood type? So now things start interacting with you. Maybe not because you have the blood type, but because you think that you have an extra connection because of the blood type, and then it causes this connection to entities. We have to put that in our minds too. Entities will trick, play games, and it's not always what it seems. But there are some weird things that surround the Rh negative blood type, which we are going to talk about. Now, I did bring up the 13 bloodlines, and I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about them just briefly. And I'm not a huge opponent on the 13 bloodline theory. I'm going to do an episode one day about it and tell you guys what I think about it. I think there are elite families. I don't know if it's 13 by the numbers. You know what I mean? Because there's so many different names get thrown around. I honestly believe if there is a group that would be considered 13 bloodlines, we probably wouldn't know many of their names, if at all. They would be elite families that will have been protected for centuries. Or if we do know their names, we don't know much about them. So some of the names that are talked about in the mainstream, we've got the Astor family, got the Bundy family, Collins family, DuPont, Freeman, Kennedys, Lees, Onassis, Reynolds, Rockefeller, Rothschilds, Russell, Van Doon. Those are the 13 that are talked about as being part of these 13 bloodlines. My only issue with that is when it comes to an elite group of people who are protecting, whether you think they're alien, reptilian, or Nephilim bloodlines, they wouldn't all be out there like that. They would be to an extent. And a lot of times I think some of these families are just front men for who the actual families are. They take on the moniker as being the 13 bloodlines. And maybe they are part of a group of 13 families who are the front men for these other families who are behind the scenes. And that's just my take on if there is some sort of elite structure of bloodlines. I don't think that we know a whole lot about them. Some of them we might be able to look through history and say, well, I know these historical figures and they are part of this family name and I can look to what they've done on Earth, but we can't go to say exactly what they've done behind the scenes. You know, it's like the Merovingians. We don't know everything about this particular bloodline and what they've been doing for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. We know what history's told us, but we don't know behind the scenes. So again, I think it would be very arrogant of us to think that we have 13 names figured out for some 13 bloodlines. I don't think it really operates that way. Now, the thought pattern is, if we take on the 13 bloodlines, or even if, like I'm suggesting, they're just frontmen as a part of an elite bloodline structure, that they would dip outside of their families, and I mean that literally, when they're having relations with other people to create bastard family members who would be able to be utilized by the family for other purposes, but wouldn't have the family last name. Now, that I do agree with to some extent, because I think that if you're looking at, say, the Rockefellers or the Rothschilds, we'll just bring up the two most famous, and say that they wanted to implement one of their family members into some form of government or entertainment to use them to control people to some extent, they might have a bastard child from someone else, raise them as part of the family, and then implement them into said vocation. And that way, they would be able to manipulate them to manipulate other people, but they wouldn't be directly tied back to them. And you'll see this a lot throughout historical figures where people suggest that so-and-so was actually of this bloodline because of these connections, but there's no way to actually track it. It's all just theories. I love it when people are like, no, he or she did. They are from that family, and I know. You know a theory. You don't know for sure. None of us do. We can try to figure it out a million different ways, but we're always going to roll back to a specific theory. Now, what is Rh negative blood? Karl Landsteiner and Alexander Wiener played the most significant role in identifying the rhesus blood type. So I'm going to break down Karl Landsteiner and Alexander Solomon Wiener here for you, just to give a little background on who these guys are. Karl Landsteiner was German. He was Austrian-American biologist, physician, and immunologist. He immigrated with his family to New York in 1923 at the age of 55 for professional opportunities working for the Rockefeller Institute. So, interestingly enough, one of the key figures in coming up with the idea of the Rh negative blood type, or putting it into the medical mind frame, was a guy who immediately started working for the Rockefeller Institute, which we just talked about, the Rockefellers being part of these 13 bloodlines, or what people consider the 13 bloodlines. Now, we can point to the Rockefellers being integral in all kinds of different machinations, from the medical world, the education world, politics, the industrial sector, all these different things. So we know that the Rockefellers are a very powerful family. The fact that here's a guy who puts this Rh negative blood type into the medical mind frame, literally moves here in 1923 and immediately starts working for the Rockefeller Institute. I find that interesting. You know, you could say I'm grasping for straws, and maybe it's just all circumstantial. It could be. But I do find it interesting that we're considering these Nephilim bloodlines to be connected to these elite families. And here's an elite family who hires Carl Landsteiner, and Carl Landsteiner breaks down this Rh negative blood type along with Alexander Wiener. And Alexander Wiener was an American biologist and physician specializing in the fields of forensic medicine, serology, and immunogenics. His work led to the discovery of the Rh factor in 1937 with Carl Landsteiner, and subsequently to the development of exchange transfusion methods that saved the lives of infants with hemolytic disease of the newborn. The Rh factor, when they discovered it in 1937, it's named after the rhesus monkeys used as test subjects. So that's where this Rh negative comes from. Now, initially, they found this Rh negative blood type, but they didn't know if there was anything significant to it. That's the mainstream version. I'm just looking at Landsteiner coming to America and immediately working for Rockefellers. And all of a sudden, he puts this new blood type into the American mind frame and the worldwide mind frame. But it was seen as yet another factor, not much different from the MN or P factors useful for fingerprinting. So if you got a certain blood type, they can look to your genealogy, your DNA. Generally, does it mean that someone can't have a different blood type from someone with a previous blood type? That's always happening. What I'm saying is it's useful to fingerprint a person to some extent. However, Wiener soon realized that the new blood factor they had discovered was associated with problems in blood transfusions. Although the first time Rh positive blood is transfused into someone with Rh negative blood, it may not cause any harm. It does cause the creation of antibodies, which make a second such transfusion very dangerous. By the time he and Landsteiner published in 1940, Wiener was able to demonstrate the role of Rh synthetization as a cause of intergroup hemolytic reactions, thus increasing the safety of blood transfusion. So, in layman's terms, they're figuring out that there is a problem in transfusions when it comes to this Rh negative blood type. Now, they're saying when it's transfused the first time, it doesn't cause any problems, but the second time can be very dangerous and even cause death. So they're trying to figure that out. They know something's weird with it. However, I think they knew more than that they were letting on, because as we break down the Rh negative factor further, there are just weird anomalies that come along with it. Some of it's scientific, some of it's just what people have said. Hundreds and thousands of people who have it have said that they've dealt with having this blood type. And we're going to get into that. Now, the very interesting thing that goes along with the Rh negative blood type, it only appears in about 15% of the entire global population. And it's been a source of interest among scientists and medical professionals since it was first identified in the 1930s. Now, the reason for this, save for its rarity, is that we do not currently know where it comes from. Now, this is scientific. No one knows, can track where this actually comes from. It is an anomaly. It is an anomaly blood type that no one can look to and say, this was the source of it. So this apparent gap in our knowledge has allowed some theorists to insert their own ideas for how the blood type came to be, i.e. through external intervention. And here comes the humanist reaction to it. They say it's a wonderful example of the aliens of the gaps argument, or gods of the gaps argument, used by creationists where a phenomenon is credited to a deity. There's no agreed explanation for it. And I'm going to break down just briefly what God of the gaps theory is, or aliens of the gaps theory is. According to humanists, these are people who only adhere to the Big Bang and evolution. The God of the gaps theory refers to poorly made arguments assuming that if a phenomenon doesn't have an immediate explanation, then it can be credited to a deity. Creationists often rely on this fallacy in an attempt to cast aspersions on the veracity of evolution by pointing to supposed gaps in the fossil record and claiming that because scientists cannot yet explain them, an intelligent designer must instead be responsible for the natural world. The theory essentially uses God to fill in any gaps in human understanding. I don't think that's the case at all. I think there are major gaps in the fossil records. Now, we can argue where those gaps come in. And I know I've talked to Justin England from Crypts of the Corn several times about evolutionary theory, and the gap in those said archaeological finds. And listen, there is a level of evolution that exists, absolutely. I think we can look at things adapting over time. I just don't think, again, I've said this plenty of times on the show, that there is any evidence for whole species changing into another whole species. And it's funny because there's this humanistic thinking that acts like it's superior to people who believe in God. But when you get to the highest levels of science and understanding, most of them believe in some sort of divine origin because they have their hands on things the average person doesn't have. The idea that everything came from nothing, even though evolutionists will say that that's not the case, it's more complex than that. Let's just put it in simple layman's terms. Something appeared out of nothing. To say that's the God of the gaps theory, sure, you can say creationism's a theory. I'm an adherent to that because it's a belief system. I completely agree with that. But to say that evolution's not a theory or not a belief system, I think that's the issue I have with it. If you want to say you believe in it and it's your belief system, totally fine with that. Let's just say it for what it is, which a lot of people in the ancient alien sphere or biblical sphere or reptilian sphere, whatever you want to say, will say and point to the fact that no one, not even scientists, can tell us where it comes from. So I don't think it's a stretch to say that if you have a belief system in creation and a divine entity that something integrated with 15% of the entire global population to create this. I think it's possible. Now, do I think that everybody with this Rh negative blood type has some sort of superhuman powers or they're connected to something someone else isn't? I don't know. I don't think everyone with the Rh negative blood type is privy to this. I know plenty of people who have told me, I don't have anything happen. This is stupid. I have Rh negative. I know the risk with it. I know the pregnancy risk. And I know how to operate around it. It's science. Agree. I do agree with them on that. I think that sometimes we can get so lost in this, I've got Nephilim blood. And to that point, I know I make jokes about me coming from Nephilim blood because I have red hair and I'm a ginger. That I don't know. I really don't. So let's be honest here when it comes to me. Like, that's just me joking on the show, and I'll continue to joke on the show or other people's shows about that. But I think there's a part of people who like to think that they have Nephilim blood in them. It makes them feel special, especially if they don't feel special. And if they're having paranormal occurrences around them, they feel really special. Even if it's negative things happening, they feel special because of it. Now, are these blood types connected to these things? I know there's been talk of certain people with certain blood types, Rh negative being one of them, that are taken by extraterrestrials, and I do it with quotations, these Nephilim meat sacks, as I like to call them, to create offspring for these fallen entities. It's a possibility. And maybe the blood type makes it easier for that. Because if it does come from a Nephilim origin, it could be that the person that has it, a female vessel, would be able to gestate a Nephilim hybrid easier. And I've heard the argument, and I'm not saying it's not a possibility. I mean, listen, I've said a million times on the show, if we're even going to give the possibility of Nephilim, we have to give the possibility to the rest of it too in the theory realm. So I'm not going to say that it's not possible. And I've heard women that have dealt with these abductions, and a lot of them have this particular blood type. So there is the argument. Now, back to, there's no clear consensus on why some people have this Rh negative blood type, but there could be just a normal explanation for it too. It could be the way that genes mutate. It could be that blood types have mutated. I believe that mutations are provable. We know that through science. And a good example would be eye color. So it's said that original humans' eyes were browned, But around 6,000, 10,000 years ago, a genetic mutation slipped in which turned off the ability to produce enough melanin to sustain this color in some people. Now, you're going to have people that say that's when the fallen angels connected with the daughters of men, and this was this mutation that slid in. It's possible. It's possible, but you're going to get that from a certain group of people who want to claim that their skin tone is a godly skin tone and everyone else isn't. Again, I've heard it all, but let's just say this in just genetic terms. Now, this led to the emergence of other colors such as blue, green, and hazel eyes. The eye color is not the result of a particular pigment, but rather the relative absence of higher concentrations of melanin to make them brown. So we can even look to mollusk shells. They do the same thing. You can look at all the different patterns and colors that they will have, and it's operating at a similar genetic mutation. So maybe the Rh negative is just some sort of mutation that 15% of the world has. But there are some weird anomalies that do happen with a high number of reported people who have the blood type. So I think that's where people get this idea that there's something else to it. And I don't disagree with them. I think there's probably something to it. However deep it goes, I'm not sure. And again, if you have it, you are just as redeemable as anyone else. Do not let anyone tell you that ever. Matter of fact, if they start talking that way, just walk away. Just know that God and his mercy and grace has given you the path to him, just like anybody else that walks this earth. Now, according to some researchers like Robert Speer, he's an author, producer, independent anthropologist, YouTuber, and expert in languages, archaeology, and paleobiology. And he's written quite a few books when it comes to the conspiratorial world, books such as 1666, Redemption Through Sin, Global Conspiracy in History, Religion, Politics, and Finance, Occult Secrets of Viril, Species with Amnesia, I've Forgotten History. He's a huge proponent on the Rh negative being of some sort of alien origin or Nephilim origin. And he talks about how that 85% of humans have Rh positive blood, yet all royal families have Rh negative blood. That's a theory. We don't know that for a fact. We can suggest it with what we know. And honestly, with what I told you earlier, with the Rockefeller family being initially involved in getting the information out of the Rh negative blood type, we could point to certain things in history and say, well, there could be something there. But to say that everybody in these royal families has this Rh negative blood type, I don't know. To suggest maybe they have some sort of blood type that's connected to the gods or Elohim or fallen entities or Nephilim, I think that's a little more plausible. And I don't even think that all of these hybrids had the same blood type either. That's a huge stretch and huge suggestion. So again, if you have Rh negative blood type, relax. We're just going into what happens with some of these people that do have it, not all. So I don't know if you know, but the Rh negative mother carrying an Rh positive child will actually try to reject their own offspring in the womb. Now, I actually pulled this report up from the National Library of Medicine, so the skeptic doesn't think I'm just grasping at straws from all over the place. Rh incompatibility. Rh incompatibility is a condition that develops when a pregnant woman has Rh negative blood and the baby in her womb has Rh positive blood. Causes: during pregnancy, red blood cells from an unborn baby can cross into the mother's blood through the placenta. If the mother is Rh negative, her immune system treats Rh positive fetal cells as if they were a foreign substance. The mother's body makes antibodies against the fetal blood cells. These antibodies may cross back through the placenta into the developing baby. They destroy the baby's circulating red blood cells. This can actually kill the baby if not taken care of, and there are ways to take care of it. So the main treatment now for this particular thing that can happen if a mother has Rh negative and the child has Rh positive is a thing called a Rogam, R-H-O-G-A-M. It is a shot that can be implemented into the mother. It will allow passive antibodies immunosuppression, which could prevent the Rh synthesization, which we were talking about earlier. So the best way to say it is a shot is given to a mother, which blocks the suppression from the antibodies rising up against the blood type of the baby within her, which is interesting. Why is this particular blood type trying to unalive this baby within them, and it's only relegated to 15% of the world? Nobody, no scientists, nobody who studied it. They just know it exists and they consider a mutation. That's their overarching explanation for it, is that it's a mutation and we don't know where it came from. It's just like everything else in the world. We have no idea where it came from. It just came out of nowhere. Now, to get into a little bit more of the paranormal side for the people that were waiting to hear that, here are some of the traits that are alleged that people with the Rh negative blood type have. Some of these are physical features paired with a predilection for psychic phenomena and alien abduction. So this is where we get the idea that women that have this Rh negative blood type are abducted and are subject to experiments, including siring children inside of them from these aliens. But some of the features with people that have Rh negative are higher than average IQ, lower body temperature, higher blood pressure, reddish hair, extra vertebrae, sensitive vision, and particularly sensitivity to sunlight, and elevated intuition. Now, you will hear people that have Rh negative that have a lot, if not all of these. Some people that have Rh negative blood type don't have any of these. So what is it? Is there something that unlocks the abilities? There's another idea. Maybe the blood type is purely Nephilim or purely from some sort of fallen descent or Elohim descent. And there has to be something to unlock it. Now, it's also said that skulls of people with Rh negative have some sort of oblong shape. People point to South America and the bizarrely shaped oblong Paraca skulls. You may have seen those with the little red hair that's attached to them. I don't think everybody with the Rh negative blood type has these oblong skulls. I know people point to the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds have very similar skulls like the Paraca skulls. That's just another one of those theories that's thrown out in conjunction with the Rh negative that I don't think has a lot of weight to it. It's possible, right? But at the end of the day, I also think that some of these things just get lumped together in this theory and they keep piling on. Before you know it, somebody's freaking out because they were born with a blood type that they can't help that they were born with. And then they think that they are doomed for eternity because you've got fearmongers preaching the gospel of every Nephilim bloodline's going to hell. And to shift into the final little bit here, because of what I just said, I want to talk about Mark 16:15. This is part of the Great Commission. And he said to them, Jesus, go into the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He didn't say mankind. He didn't say to every man. He said every creature. And the Greek word is katesis, which literally means all of creation, everything that's on this earth. So to every katesis, every creature, we're supposed to reach out to and preach the gospel. And lastly, to the people who have been a deterrent of this theory, I will repeat a verse from last week's, 1 John 4:1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world. I would encourage you to pray and test the spirits, even when it comes to me, to see if I am perpetrating some sort of falsehood or trying to be a false prophet to lead people astray. I do not try to do that in any way possible. And if I ever do anything that is, at least in my mind, that comes off that way as I listen to something later on, or I'm studying something later, I do try to come back and amend that. Because again, I think with these theories, we're always theorizing. I may look back at Good Nephilim 2 years from now and have a whole different concept to it, or more things added to it, which I think is more likely, because I think that this is a topic that needs to be talked about more in the Christian space. Because I think what it does when we realize that God's here for all of us, then we really start getting away from this mentality of doom and gloom, and we're going to die, and woe is me, and I don't need to build for my family. Because who knows? We may be here for another 20,000 years. We don't know. But I really appreciate you guys. You guys have been awesome. This has been an interesting series. I've gotten so much great feedback from people, and I'm really glad that people were able to connect with us in a way I wasn't sure if they would or not. But I'm really glad that people did. And honestly, it grew my faith the more I studied this particular topic. And you know what I do before I get out of here, guys? I like to read some 5-star reviews and some comments. If you enjoyed this series, if you enjoyed this episode, please right now while I'm talking to you, go give me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. Write a nice review on Apple. If you're here on YouTube, like, share, subscribe, hit the notifications. Make sure you write a comment too on YouTube, because that helps drive the algorithm. I think people don't understand that comments are what really drives the algorithm in conjunction with likes and everything else. We'll start with Apple Podcasts, as we do every week. Bamboo Noother, love the show. I love and appreciate the way Joel's brain works. Always well researched and coming in with great insight. One of my favorite podcasts. Looking forward to many episodes in the future. Appreciate that, Bamboo Noother. We've got Greetings Earthlings. Interesting and well researched. This is not your run-of-the-mill boring podcast. Joel's personal experiences provide him a lot of insight into his topics, but he also does incredible research. Not only are the topics interesting, Joel is engaging, pleasant to listen to, and well-spoken. I enjoy learning from podcasts I subscribe to, and my favorite genres tend to be more fringe-type topics with a Christian foundation, and Joel marks all of those boxes. Appreciate that. Greetings, Earthlings. We've got MDNKSJSJ. The Earth is flat. 5 stars. And I know why you put that there, but I can totally appreciate flat earthers that give me a 5-star and then tell me that the Earth's flat. That's the way to do it. And I appreciate you guys just like the Globers too. I appreciate everyone who's here, and we can all have different ideas and appreciate each other. And that's one thing that I love about this show and the people that listen to the show. All right, guys, we're going to go to Spotify. We've got Keith. I would love to hear an episode on the Trinity. I've had the hardest time understanding the Trinity, just as always seemed like Satan has tried to take the glory away from Jehovah and give it to Jesus. Now that Jesus isn't our Redeemer. If you understand it all, please help. Thanks. Keith, that would be an entire episode for sure. And the Trinity is an interesting topic, and I know theologians have argued over the Trinity for thousands of years, at least AD, past couple thousand. And maybe I do one day. I don't know. Or maybe I talk about it in conjunction with something else. But it's interesting, and I hope to touch on it at some point. We got Ben Banks Online. Love your podcast. Keep it up. Appreciate that, Ben Banks Online. We have Van. Another great episode. I could listen to you talk about this all day long. It's also fascinating. Thank you, Van. It is fascinating, and I have a blast myself. You have no idea when I'm discovering new things, especially with this good Nephilim theory. I've had an absolute blast. All right, we're going to go to YouTube. We have Davian Clark, 5151. We might not agree on everything as far as our personal beliefs in this strange reality, but you are a treasure trove of extremely intriguing information. You've definitely added a lot of my pieces to my puzzle. Appreciate that, Davian Clark. I agree. I don't agree with most everybody I know. That's the beauty of it. We all have all these different pieces that we can at least get some sort of idea what's going on, right? But at the same time, not letting it control us, living our lives. We've got Jody Leah, 144. I really enjoyed part one, and this one was even better. I'm looking forward to the rest. Keep up the awesome work, Joel. Thank you. Thank you for more. Thank you for all your research and stellar delivery, Joel. Thank you, El Mohican. I really appreciate it. Again, you guys have been fantastic throughout this series, and we're done with it for now. Until down the road, I may add an addendum episode, but I can't wait to get to some other topics I've been working on too, but really appreciate you guys again. If you can, go give a 5-star review where you can, leave a comment where you can. Love you guys, all you guys. We're going to play Gray on the way out, And you know what it is, guys? Go outside, touch grass, and get your tail out the hole.
I'm trying to be me, but every time I do, they point their fingers at me. Sometimes I wanna scream. I can't fit within their kaleidoscope of what they want me to believe. But I can't fade to black. But I can't fade to black. It's all in the grind. Skills can't balance the white. Colors bleed out the frame. Black and white on the side. It's all in the grind. Skills can't balance the white. Colors bleed out the frame. Black and white on the side. I don't know if I lie to myself every time I say my family's on my mind. That don't mean I don't care. It's just sometimes I feel stretched thin, and I know that isn't fair. But I can't. But every time I